May it please the court. Good afternoon. I'm John Culver. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Life Touch Church Directories and Portraits. The trial of this case should have been focused on whether defendants misappropriated the plaintiff's trade secrets. Instead, because the trial court permitted defendants to introduce irrelevant yet highly inflammatory evidence, the trial turned into a sideshow about erroneous allegations of fraud and unclean hands. Setting aside the hyperbole, defendants' allegations and evidence amounted to little more than defendant Inglesby's subjective gripes about the job that Life Touch offered her. As a matter of law, none of the evidence that defendants introduced supported the affirmative defenses of fraud or unclean hands. The trial court compounded its error in admitting that evidence by denying plaintiff's motion for directed verdict on defendant's fraud defense. By denying that motion, the defendants were entitled to spend large chunks of their closing argument on this irrelevant but prejudicial information. The fact that the jury was instructed on that defense gave it a level of credibility that was not supported by the evidence or the law. So the court erred both in denying the directed verdict filed by the plaintiffs regarding these affirmative defenses and by denying plaintiff's motion to eliminate to keep that evidence out. And I want to start by discussing the lack of evidence as a matter of law regarding the fraudulent misrepresentation.
Before you get to that, counsel, do you view the testimony regarding the statement by the vice president of your company as irrelevant and not significant?
They are irrelevant with respect to the affirmative defenses asserted by the defendants in the case. Fraudulent misrepresentation, fraudulent concealment, and unclean hands. I certainly do. They weren't statements that constituted the kinds of statements upon which an individual can rely to support a fraud defense or upon which the misrepresentation element of fraud can be asserted. With respect to fraudulent misrepresentation, first of all...
Excuse me, Mr. Culver.
Yes, sir.
I understand your argument as to the fraud affirmative defenses, but are you saying that none of the evidence was admissible on the unclean hands defense as well?
Yes, we are arguing that, Your Honor. Under well-established Colorado law, unclean hands only exists if there's evidence of fraud. We've argued that there was no evidence of fraud. And secondly, there can be evidence of unclean hands defense can be supported when there's evidence of unconscionable conduct, not evidence that an individual doesn't like the other party's conduct, not evidence that they don't think the other side has treated them in the most fair way, but it has to rise to the level of actual unconscionable conduct. And in this case, there was no evidence of unconscionable conduct. First of all, The evidence regarding whether or not defendant Inglesby was mistreated is just subjective opinion. There's no sort of objective issue regarding whether or not defendant Inglesby was treated unfairly. She didn't like how she was treated when the defendants exercised their business judgment, but there isn't anything to say there was an objective wrongdoing on the plaintiff's part.
What's the difference between objective and subjective in this circumstance?
Well, There's case law regarding what constitutes unclean hands. And what constitutes unclean hands is fraud. There can be objective evidence of fraud. There can be objective evidence of unconscionable conduct. A physical assault, yelling, screaming, lying, all of those things can constitute unconscionable conduct. The evidence here was simply that defendant Inglesby didn't like the territory she got, and she didn't like the way in which she was asked to sign her employment agreement. The defendants in this case didn't cite a single case in which such situations like that could give rise to an unclean hands defense. Now, certainly, if someone can say, anytime someone enters into a contract, they can say later that they didn't like the contract, they didn't like how the contract was negotiated, they didn't like the outcome of the contract negotiations, an unclean hands defense would be available in absolutely every case where there was a contract. And obviously, that isn't the case. And in this case, the defendants can only point to a handful of things that could constitute unclean hands. Fraud. There is no fraud as a matter of law. The second issue that they argue is that she was only given 48 hours to consider her employment agreement. Of course, there isn't any case law that says 48 hours is not a sufficient amount of time for an individual to consider a contract. In fact, the law is to the contrary. The law cited by the plaintiffs in our brief and during the trial is that there's no duress or coercion in entering into a contract when an employer says to an employee, in order for you to have the job, you have to make certain agreements to us. In this case, the plaintiff had to enter into a non-solicitation agreement. The law is very clear that that kind of conditioning a job on giving away certain rights is something that doesn't constitute duress or coercion. There's not any case law, and not any case law, not any fact, not any even argument as to why 48 hours wasn't enough for her to consider the agreement. And this is not a completely unsophisticated person. Defendant Inglesby.
Yeah, but excuse me, you left out a couple of the facts, it seems to me. Okay. You left out the fact that when she was given the employment agreement to sign, she's in another city on a business trip, and she's told, after she says, I'd like some time to talk to a lawyer, she's told, well, no, then you'll have to get right on an airplane to go home, and the job may not be available on Monday. Those are facts in addition to just giving someone 48 hours, aren't they?
Well, sure, Your Honor, but the case law on duress and coercion says that by using as a lever something that the party doesn't have to provide the other side, is not coercive. I mean, and in this case, LifeTouch was doing Ms. Inglesby a favor, and in fact, all the Olin Mills sales representatives a favor. LifeTouch didn't have to offer them jobs. When they acquired Olin Mills, they could have opened those sales representatives' positions opened the competitive bid, and filled those positions through interviews. In this case, LifeTouch was actually offering her a job that they didn't have to offer her. And one of the conditions for the job was that she enter into this agreement. She also accepted a $500 bonus, which she received, for entering into the agreement within the 48 hours instead of taking a longer period of time to do that. So, yes, there are more facts than just the 48 hours. I'm not sure that they're material facts. And this is not an unsophisticated person. It's undisputed, and this is on the record. Defendant Inglesby worked for Olin Mills and had an employment agreement with Olin Mills that contained a non-competition agreement. So she understood how those kind of contracts work. And in fact, the Olin Mills agreement was significantly broader and more onerous than was the LifeTouch agreement. The Olin Mills employment agreement was a full-on non-compete. You can't work for any competitor for a year after you leave your employment with Olin Mills. The agreement that she entered into with LifeTouch was significantly more narrow. It only provided that she couldn't use the plaintiff's trade secrets and she couldn't solicit LifeTouch customers for a period of time after she left. She was free to solicit churches that had not been contacted in the past by LifeTouch that didn't have contracts with her. So it was a significantly more narrow agreement than was entered into with LifeTouch. And I've yet, certainly the defendants in this case haven't cited any case law that says this sort of scenario, which is very common in the employment context, of conditioning a job on entering into a non-competition agreement or entering into an arbitration agreement. There's a well-established body of law on this. It's not like we only provided her 10 minutes. She was given 48 hours. Yes, she was out of town, but she certainly had a phone, had opportunities to call and meet other people. The reason LifeTouch couldn't give her more time is they were about to share confidential information with her. And they had to get the training. The meeting in Atlanta was partially a training in which confidential information was provided to her. So she was being told, before we'll give you the confidential information, you have to agree not to use the confidential information. It's a very common thing for a business to do. It's a very common thing to be done in the employment context. And the case law that defendants cite, they don't come anywhere near this kind of a situation. The Salzman case involved evidence in which they cite for the unclean hands defense, involved evidence of actual fraud. The Whiting Oil and Gas Corporation case held that even when the defendant violated its duty of good faith and fair dealing, that was insufficient to establish the unclean hands defense as a matter of law. And the only other case they cite is Premier Farm Credit, which held that a finding of actual misrepresentations by the plaintiff was insufficient to support application of the unclean hands defense. The application of the unclean hands defense that the defendants have asserted in this case is something that goes well, well beyond what any of the case law regarding unclean hands supports. It, in essence, supports this situation where a party to a contract can always argue they don't have to comply with the contract because they don't like the circumstances surrounding the formation of the contract, even if there's nothing coercive about the way in which the contract was formed. And as a matter of law, there was no coercion regarding how the employment agreement was formed. Now, we've been focusing on the unclean hands defense, but there's reversible error in this case simply based on the fraud. And the reason that there's reversible error is the court denied the plaintiff's directed verdict regarding the fraud affirmative defense and instructed the jury regarding the fraud affirmative defense. And there was no special verdict that indicates whether the jury decided for the defendants based on the fraud affirmative defense or whether they found that the plaintiffs simply hadn't proved their case. And consequently, there's a very significant possibility that the jury in this case found against the plaintiff on all of the trade secret claims based on the instruction that there was a fraud affirmative defense. And I think our case is very strong that as a matter of law, there is no fraud, there was no evidence of fraudulent misrepresentation or concealment in this case for the reasons that are described in our brief.
Did you preserve that error by objecting to the jury instruction or the verdict form?
We objected to all of the instructions and the verdict form that dealt with fraudulent misrepresentation. We said the jury should not have been instructed on that at all. We also moved for directed verdict on the affirmative defense of fraud. So, and I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Jack Tanner with Fairfield and Woods. With me is my partner, Colin Walker. We're here on behalf of the defendants. This was a case about trade secrets. I agree with Mr. Culver on that. One place I particularly disagree with is one of his final comments. This fraud in the inducement affirmative defense we're talking about played no role in the decision on trade secrets. It was included in the instructions and included on the jury verdict form specifically regarding the breach of contract claim. The trade secret claim failed because there were no trade secrets in this case. And quite frankly, once the trade secret claim failed, plaintiff was going to lose the rest of the case just because that was the entire focus of its case. What plaintiff tried to do was bootstrap and protect this covenant not to compete, which is void under Colorado law, absent trade secrets. Plaintiff filed a complaint seeking a permanent injunction to enforce that covenant not to compete. By doing so, he invoked equity and therefore had to do equity, and that's where the unclean hands defense comes in. I disagree with his attempt to distinguish our cases on unclean hands. What's important to remember fundamentally on this is we're here on an abuse of discretion standard on this instruction. Was it an abuse of discretion for the court to give this instruction? They're not complaining about the terminology of the instruction, just that it was given at all. The cases show that unclean hands does not require criminal conduct. It doesn't require fraudulent conduct. It's an all facts and circumstances test. The Premier Credit case cited in our brief specifically says that. You look at all the facts. It doesn't have to be criminal conduct. The Whiting Oil case, which was mentioned by Mr. Culver, and I'll just let the court know, both the briefs refer to that with only the Westlaw site because the Pacific Reporter site wasn't available at the time. It's now available, 321P3D500, the pinpoint site, page 508. The Whiting Oil case, again, what happened there was the trial court judge granted equitable relief, declining to give credence to the unclean hands defense. And the question that went up on appeal, was that an abuse of discretion? And the Court of Appeals held it was not an abuse of discretion. The Court of Appeals held that the test for unclean hands was different than the test for breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And just because the plaintiff breached that implied covenant doesn't mean the plaintiff also had unclean hands. It's a different test. It's a different analysis. And what the Whiting Oil case says is not an abuse of discretion. And
Mr. Tanner, was your evidence of fraud different than evidence of unclean hands, or are they the same?
Not really. I think it's the same. I mean, what we looked at was the conduct surrounding the execution of the covenant not to compete. And it's some of the things that were mentioned during the earlier opening. It's an out-of-town trip, given 48 hours, most of which occurred over a weekend. But primarily, it is the statements, the affirmative statements made by LifeTouch, which subsequent events clearly showed LifeTouch had no intention of honoring. Particularly, Mr. Grillo saying, before we asked the sales reps to sign this covenant not to compete, we didn't tell them what their new territories were going to be. We knew they were going to be unhappy, so we intentionally withheld that information. Did not tell them what their new territories were going to be. Only after they signed, then did we tell them that the new territories were going to be. That is a lie. That is fraud. That is withholding material information. Additionally, plaintiffs told all the sales reps, we will do our best to keep you as close to home as possible. Now, the argument is that sort of too vague to be enforced. I understand that argument. But again, look at subsequent events. When the territories came out, Ms. Inglesby found out her territory, said it was literally in tears. Her closest church was 75 miles away. When she raised these issues, the salesman who had been the light touch salesman all along, Mr. Vanderlei, who was given the lucrative Denver territory, offered to give up some of his territory to her because he recognized the unfairness of that division. They went to light touch, and the answer was absolutely not, with no explanation. Even through trial a year later, light touch never explained. Well, when the rep who got the lucrative Denver territory offers to give up part of it so Ms. Inglesby can be close to home, like you promised, why didn't you do that? Never an explanation. That's another badge of fraud. A third badge of fraud, as cited in our brief, is the great disparity of bargaining power, and that's something that's already talked about the out-of-state meeting. So when you look at all those cumulatively, we don't have to look at any, was this one enough or was this one enough, but look at it cumulatively, there's evidence in the record that would support both an instruction on fraudulent inducement of the contract, which was given, and there's evidence that would support unclean hands, which is the judge, that issue, of course, went to the judge for the permanent injunction, which he denied giving, which I would say, once the jury came back and found no trade secrets, and again, none of this that we're talking about had anything to do with the trade secret part of the case. There's not an instruction in the trade secret area that refers to unclean hands or fraud. The jury verdict form, that question about fraud is specifically about breach of contract, has nothing to do with the trade secret issue. So once the jury came in on trade secrets, I really think the plaintiff was sunk. And so let me move on. Again, both for unclean hands and the admission of all this evidence, this is all an abuse of discretion standard. And this is another disagreement I have with counsel. I don't find in the record any motion for directed verdict under Rule 50 at the end of the case. If you look at the pages they cite in their brief, they specifically cite the pages 60, 61, and 70 of the April 5th transcript. That's jury instruction argument. That's all it is. There was not a time that I recall from the trial, and I didn't see one in the record, where the opponent stood up and said, we want a directed verdict under Rule 50 on the fraudulent misrepresentation affirmative defense. Not there. And so, as a result, we're on all this evidence is on an abuse of discretion standard. And you can't say, given the evidence, given the pleadings in the case, that it was an abuse of discretion for the court to allow this evidence in. In their briefs, they and during opening argument, the plaintiffs complained about the denial of their pretrial motion in limine. Well, in response to that motion in limine, what we did was we attached Mr. Grillo, the vice president, we attached his deposition, submitted to the trial court. You can find that in the record at pages 1722 through 1733. And what Mr. Grillo said is, we knew the sales reps were going to be disappointed. We did not even consider telling them in advance of signing their contract what their new territories would be. We didn't even consider it. So based on that, the trial court acted properly in denying the pretrial motion in limine. And then once we get to trial, it's the same evidence. Mr. Grillo again testified he knew the sales reps would be disappointed, and they didn't. He deliberately made a decision not to tell them until after they had signed their contracts.
Excuse me, Mr. Turner. You said a moment ago that the jury clearly found that there were no trade secrets. Can you explain? Because there's a number of elements in a misappropriation of trade secrets claim. How do we know that the jury specifically found that there were no trade secrets?
You're correct. I stand corrected, Your Honor. I spoke poorly in that regard. What I meant to say was, the jury ruled in favor of the defendant on the claim for misappropriation of trade secrets. But in that, both in the instructions regarding trade secrets and in the jury verdict form regarding trade secrets, there's no reference to this evidence that we're talking about today. And I, if I took a shortcut and misspoke, I apologize. You cannot tell why they decided not to award liability or damages for trade secrets, but we do know what they didn't rule on, which is all this evidence we're talking about today, because the instruction didn't reference that affirmative defense. again, going back to the evidence at trial, Ms. Inglesby testified that she was told nothing was going to majorly change, and yet there was a very major change, and so it was not an abuse of discretion to let all that evidence in because of the pleadings. Then once the evidence was in, it certainly supported the fraud instruction, and again, we're on an abuse of discretion standard here. The only question was there enough evidence to allow this to go to the jury, to include an instruction on it and include it in the verdict form on an abuse of discretion standard? And that was certainly met. Again, fraud can be inferred from a quick change in position without an explanation. We cite the Willard and Shaw cases in our brief at pages 23 and 24. That's what we've got. They tell them one story in Atlanta, and within 2 months, we've got a change of position without an explanation as to why they changed. You said you're going to keep us home as close to home as possible. You didn't. The other rep even offers to compromise, and you say no without explanation. A different disagreement I have, with the, particularly in the reply brief, I would point out, is in the reply brief in three different places at pages 7, 8, and 10, they claim Ms. Inglesby admitted she knew she'd be unhappy. And then where they cite to in the record doesn't say that at all, and Ms. Inglesby never testified to that. What she said was that the pages they cite to, which is the April 4 transcript of pages 183, 184, and 277, is, I knew there would have to be adjustments made to my territory because you have two reps with the same exclusive territory. There had to be adjustments made. She recognized that. But that's a far cry from knowing she would be disappointed, as Mr. Grillo testified he knew before he offered her the contract, and knowing she would be unhappy, as the reply brief suggests. I would also suggest that if this instruction was erroneous, which I don't think it was harmless error in view of the picture of this case. To even find a claim for breach of contract that doesn't involve trade secrets and the covenant not to compete, you have to look really hard. There's a technical way to read the complaint and a technical way to read the jury instructions where, in theory, the jury could have found that. But if you read the closing argument and you read the evidence that came in at trial, that's not something the plaintiff ever argued at trial. They didn't ask for a finding of breach of contract based on anything except breach of the covenant not to compete and the use of trade secrets. That argument wasn't made in closing to the jury. So it would be extraordinary for a jury to parse through all those instructions and come up with that finding of liability for breach of contract, for use of confidential information. So even if there wasn't an error regarding that instruction, it was harmless given the totality of evidence of the case.
Did you make a motion for directed verdict at the close of the plaintiff's case?
We did, as to a couple of claims, and I don't even remember which ones they were. I'm not appealing the denial of those. I think, given that this all should have gone to the jury, there was disputed evidence on every single point, it should have gone to the jury with proper instructions, which is exactly what happened. The only, just a couple minutes that I left, I just want to briefly mention the spoliation issue because it was raised in brief. Both sides agree on the spoliation issue, this abuse of discretion standard. The test is whether a party intentionally or recklessly destroyed relevant evidence. In this case, what the plaintiff offers is far short of that. The evidence at trial showed Ms. Inglesby was not computer savvy. This program, CCleaner, is advertised as to speed up slow computers. Their own expert, the plaintiff's own expert, Mr. Langerman, did not testify that it was ever even used, much less was used to destroy relevant evidence. It appears to have been installed remotely at about the same time that Ms. Inglesby called tech support because her computer was too slow. Further, there is certainly evidence that remained on her computer that if she were trying to destroy evidence would have been the first thing to go. For example, this 11-year history list, which the plaintiffs claimed at trial was one of their crown jewel trade secrets, still right there on her computer. If she were trying to destroy evidence, that would have been the first thing to go. So in light of all that evidence, the court's decision not to give the spoliation instruction was correct. It was not an abuse of discretion. And again, that's the standard we're looking at here. And then finally, I would say, not only was declining to give a spoliation instruction correct, but it was particularly correct not to give the tendered spoliation instruction. That's found in the record at page 1580. The tender spoliation instruction of the plaintiffs goes far beyond the proper spoliation instruction. It basically asks the jury be instructed that they should assume that Ms. Inglesby had destroyed evidence and that the evidence would have proved that she used confidential information to sell church directories. That's far beyond the proper spoliation instruction. So in addition to not giving an instruction, I would say that the judge particularly behaved correctly in not giving that instruction, because that was far beyond what was proper. Are there any questions? I'm done with my prepared remarks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The defendant's incorrect. Plaintiff's counsel moved for directed verdict during the jury instruction conference. If you look at the pages cited in the transcript, we very clearly cite to Rule 50 and ask for a directed verdict on those affirmative defenses. We spent more than an hour at the jury instruction conference arguing against that instruction based on the fact that there was no evidence as a matter of law. We moved for a Rule 50 directed verdict in that context. Mr. Tanner is wrong that the fraudulent inducement instruction had nothing to do with the finding of no trade secrets. At one level, we don't know whether that's the case because there wasn't a special verdict form that indicated whether the jury was deciding based on no trade secrets or based on the fraud and the inducement defense. However, if you look at the jury instructions suggest that a finding of fraudulent inducement allows a jury to find that there were no trade secrets. If you read these instructions together, it's very clear. Instruction 16 provides that if the jury finds there was fraudulent inducement, then the covenant not to compete, the non-solicitation agreement, is not enforceable. If the jury found that agreement was not enforceable, then it would be very easy, based on the other instructions, for the jury to find that there was no trade secrets. This is an incredibly prejudicial jury instruction. That's true in two respects. First of all, if you look at instruction number 13, the improper means element of a trade secret claim, it provides that the duty or the breach of duty to maintain a secrecy can be found from a duty created in an employment agreement. So in other words, if the employment agreement is found to be unenforceable, as the instructions provide, based on fraud in the inducement, then the plaintiff can't meet one of the elements of the trade secret claim. Another element that's undermined by this defense, if you look at instruction number 11, paragraph 3, the definition of a trade secret, the third part of establishing a trade secret is that the plaintiff took sufficient precautions to guarantee the secrecy of the information. The primary means that LifeTouch used to guarantee, and this is established, if you look at our summary judgment motion, if you look at the closing arguments, one of the primary ways the plaintiff established that it took sufficient precautions to protect its trade secrets was through the entry of a non-solicitation agreement. So if the jury found that based on fraud in the inducement, that agreement was not enforceable, a jury could very easily conclude that the plaintiff had not taken sufficient means to protect that trade secret. And case law cited by the plaintiff is that kind of an employment agreement alone is sufficient to establish that kind of precaution. So this is clearly material and prejudicial. And keep in mind, because we move direct to verdict, the arguments of closing are also something we can argue is prejudice the jury, and they very clearly did, as the defendants took sort of aspirational statements about the future. We'll try to be fair, we'll try to do our best, we'll try to keep you at home. Took those and called those trickery and bullying and misrepresentation, things that I don't think they are, but things that this jury instruction and the denial of the directed verdict permitted the defendants to do, something that was clearly prejudicial to the jury. There's lots and lots of case law holding that allegations of fraud on their legally basis are something that's extremely prejudicial. They would be reversible error in this case. Finally, the evidence on fraud in this case is just not even a close call. First of all, there was a disclaimer in the employment agreement that provided that the sales representatives could not be guaranteed any specific territory. The company, at its sole discretion, retained the right to either increase or decrease the territories. And LifeTouch cited lots and lots of case law from this very court holding when that kind of disclaimer exists within a contract, it is as a matter of law not reasonable for an individual to rely on representations of the contrary. Additionally, the representations that were made are not the kinds of things that any court has ever enforced as fraudulent misrepresentations of present facts. The only statements that are allegedly fraudulent were statements of aspiration. We'll try to be fair. We'll try to do right by you. We'll try to keep you close to home. We'll try to give you a fair territory. But there isn't any definition given by the vice president as to what that means. And Ms. Inglesby admitted that she knew she had not been guaranteed any specific territory. There was only an aspiration of future conduct, no statements of present material facts, nothing anyone can rely on. And for these reasons, we ask that you reverse the trial court's decision denying the directed verdict, denying the motions in limine, and remand this case for a new trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.